Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has four causes on its oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are as follows. Aluminum Company of America versus Winnie Bullock and others from Jackson County. Browning Ferris Industries and others versus Kenneth Leak and others, and Kenneth and Nydia Leak from Cameron County. Bob Sorokolit, M.D. versus Jenny S. Rose from Tarrant County, and Doris Dodd versus Lionel R. Minow, State Minister of Education, and the Wink-Loving Independent School District from Travis County. The court has allotted times for each of these causes, and the attorney should be aware of those times. The petitioner or relator may reserve a certain portion of that time for rebuttal argument by advising the marshal of our court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each of these arguments, but we will complete the arguments before the lunch break. These arguments are being recorded for the court's convenience, and if you wish to listen to a tape of the argument, you may make application to the clerk of our court. The court is now ready to hear argument from petitioner and Aluminum Company of America versus court.
May it please the court, Mr. Robert Rhodes will present argument for petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. This case concerns your old friend, Rule 215.5, a rule that I suggest to you is not in good health, as you probably know from the cards and letters you've been receiving from the courts below, from counsel, both the trial, both plaintiff and defense counsel. It's not in good health because there is no prescription yet from this court of what factors will support a trial court's finding of good cause for the admission of undesignated witness testimony. This case presents this court with a golden opportunity to do precisely that. Whether the standard that this court uses is the standard that existed up until the time of Alvarado, or the standard as we read it from Smith versus Southwest Feed Yards on until Exxon versus West Texas Gathering Company, this case presents you with all of the factors to satisfy either or both of those standards. But good cause is not the only issue that we wish to raise on appeal, Your Honors, because we also believe very strongly that the harmless error issue is one that also counsels reversing, rendering, and affirming the trial court's judgment. If I may briefly summarize what the harmless error issue is before we address the good cause argument, I want to make sure that the court's attention is addressed. There are three reasons why there is harmless error. I will only summarize them now. The first is that there was cumulative error, cumulative testimony on these witnesses' testimony. I have already given the court a chart that is contained on the back of page 21 of our application for writ. It, on the vertical axis, tracks each of the points or issues identified by the courts of appeal as the material issues raised by these two witnesses. On the horizontal axis are each of the witnesses who testified at trial on those points, and the boxes contain the page references where they gave what we believe is cumulative testimony. The quality and the quantity of that testimony certainly should satisfy the G versus Liberty Mutual test or the Alvarado versus Fair Manufacturing tests identified by this court on harmless error. Second, Your Honors, we believe that the designation by the Bullocks, the complaining party, of these witnesses and their backdoor use of that testimony, as I will describe further on the good cause point, ought to make it per se harmless error. When they are your witnesses and you've sponsored their testimony and your experts have relied on that testimony, it should not be possible for that to be harmful error. And third, Your Honors, the legal analysis used by the Court of Appeals on the harmful error issue is simply wrong and states bad precedent. The word cumulative does not appear in the Court of Appeals opinion. They did no cumulative error analysis whatsoever. Instead, they did a de novo review on a cold appellate record of the persuasiveness of this witness testimony compared to other testimony. Your Honors, we submit that that is only wrong because a cumulative error analysis should be done under G and under Alvarado, but it's also scary precedent. The idea of courts of appeals being able to cite this case to do de novo reviews of which evidence is more persuasive, and they weren't there, and could only be substituting their judgment for that of the trial court, and more importantly, the jury, stated a precedent that this court should not allow to stand.
Are you making a distinction between being able to rely on the designation by another party and non-designation and a showing of good cause based on the designation by another party?
Well, yes, Your Honor. We believe that the fact that both the complaining party, Mr. Bullets, and only the other party designated these witnesses is a much stronger claim for good cause than if there had been no designations.
So you're not claiming these were designated witnesses. You're claiming these were non-designated and relying only on a showing of good cause.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Clearly, they were undesignated by Alcoa. These witnesses were not Alcoa's witnesses. They were the Bullocks' witnesses. That's why they designated them, and that's why Alcoa did not do that. But the fact that they were designated, we believe, brings it under the good cause analysis. But to be sure, we are not claiming that there was no Rule 215.5 issue because these other parties designated them. But the trial court found good cause, and they did so, and the court did so correctly because of all of the factors which are present on this record and which will allow this court to reverse the Court of Appeals and to render judgment affirming the trial court's verdict and the finding of trial of good cause. If I may, Your Honors, it appears that there are two different tests that were used first in the first 11 cases considered by this court, culminating in Alvarado, where mere absence of surprise and even factors of suggesting that there was no trial by ambush was not going to be sufficient to find good cause. And this court made it quite clear that it was very reluctant to find good cause. Instead, what this court apparently wanted was some difficult or impossible circumstances suggesting that there was good cause for the admission of the testimony. We do not believe, Your Honors, Smith versus Southwest Feed Yards, Miller versus Bynum, Remington versus Canalis, and Exxon versus West Texas Gathering are frankly easily reconciled in those cases. Let there be no doubt, we believe that this is a positive advancement in the law because we believe that the absence of trial by ambush can, under certain circumstances, provide a compelling reason and good cause. But this case does not force you to choose between the two because we have factors that satisfy both. And I'd like to identify 10 factors. First five demonstrating no trial by ambush conclusively, and the second five demonstrating difficult or impossible circumstances that would even fit the Alvarado test. First, the Bullocks, the complaining party, designated these witnesses as their own, both fact and expert witnesses, and those designations were never withdrawn, even today. And if the Court of Appeals was affirmed by this court, we went back for a new trial, those witnesses would still be designated. The Bullocks would still have the right to call them as their witnesses, both fact and expert. Your Honors, the AMSAB versus American Savings case that we cited in our brief out of the Court of Appeals in Houston presented a case that is the most clearly, is the most analogous of any case we know, and that's where there was a designation by the complaining party of the witness. And that court, coupled with a deposition of the witness, found good cause. The second factor is that the only other party to this case, Eaton, also designated these witnesses as both fact and expert witnesses. So the only party who had not designated them was Alcoa. The third factor, Your Honors, is that there was, in fact, a deposition of both of these witnesses prior to trial. So the substance of their testimony was known. And a substance of testimony is important in the Smith versus Southwest Feed Yards and its progeny cases, then that is presented here.
Mr. Roach, let me ask a question. Would it be important to our consideration of good cause as to the reason why Alcoa didn't designate these two witnesses?
No, Your Honor. Our position is, as long as we're not claiming inadvertence, we're not forcing the court to try to delve into what the mindset of a party
was. Let me ask you, in terms of your reference to trial by ambush, if I determined that these witnesses would be very helpful because of some information they had to my case, and my opposing party had designated him as a witness. Would it be a tactical advantage to me to not designate them, to not tip my hand that there was a reason I wanted them to testify on my behalf?
Could be.
And so would the purposes of Rule 215 be thwarted by having a rule that would permit opposing parties to not designate a witness, and just because the other side designated? I mean, does that thwart really this purpose of open disclosure?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I would agree. If designation was the only factor presented in the case, then there'd be no question in my mind but that there would be some real risk of trial by ambush. This case does not require this court to say designation alone constitutes good cause, because you've got designations, you've got depositions, you've got the testimony being introduced, being deposition testimony. And as I'll demonstrate later, you also have use, backdoor use of this testimony by the designating party when they sponsored these witnesses' testimony to their live testifying expert, said, read these guys' testimony. They will allow you to testify to gross negligence on the following basis. And that's the other exhibit or visual aid that I've handed the court that reflected in that memorandum. There was that use made by the counsel for the Bullocks, directing the testifying expert to read these very depositions and to use them to testify to Alcoa's gross negligence.
So if I understand your response to Justice Enoch, if we were to simply establish a rule that designation by an opponent or another party in the case, I suppose, of an expert was sufficient to establish good cause, that kind of narrow rule would really thwart open discovery and increase trial by ambush.
I believe that's exactly right.
You would say that, though, that it does not have that bad effect if you combine designation with deposition, with having to have their deposition? Do you have to have that, and that the opposing party has made some use of the same evidence?
I would not go so far as to say use is required, Your Honor. I think, consistent with the court's decisions in Exxon and Smith, if I might distill what I think the element is, if the substance of that testimony is clearly known and the identity of the witness is known because the other party designated them, then that could constitute good cause. I hasten to add, it's still up to the trial court to decide whether or not that's enough. And I believe that there is a salutary purpose to 215.5 in allowing the trial court to make that decision. But I do believe that designation coupled with the substance of the testimony being known by all parties more than 30 days in advance of trial protects the salutary purpose of 215.5 and prevents trial by ambush.
Is there any reason why one party wouldn't just all the witnesses designated by every other party?
Well, Your Honor, that is often done. It may be the safest thing to do, but should that be required is the question that we believe has to be answered.
But my question is, how does that help or hinder discovery or trial by ambush? The fact that it has such an easy remedy, which is simply to say, and besides that, we designate everybody else is designated, or may designate.
Your Honor, the problem with 215.5 as it is currently used, and I'm going a little far afield here, but doctrinally, there is a problem with using a discovery rule for trial control purposes. The purpose of the discovery rules, is so that every conceivable witness, fact and expert, is designated. Okay? So anybody and everybody, whether they are going to be used for trial or not, ought to be designated with that line of thinking, Your Honor, in order to be safe. But for trial purposes, having 1,000 witnesses who are potentially callable is simply unworkable, which is why so many trial courts go to pretrial orders, which in essence limits the number of witnesses and limits the witnesses to those identified on the pretrial order. The problem, if I may take the liberty, Your Honor, is that 215.5 is a discovery rule being used for trial purposes. And that's the problem. If the Rules Committee could do anything salutary, it might be to provide some sort of mediator, a converter box, if you will, between discovery and trial for purposes of the designation of all these witnesses.
And why wouldn't that be the better place to handle this in the Rules Committee instead of changing the rules midway through this case?
Well, Your Honor, if the Rules Committee did the right thing, then that'd be fine. You wouldn't need this case or any other case, for that matter, to rule and provide salutary benefits. On the other hand, Your Honor, there's no assurance that the Rules Committee will do that. More importantly, Your Honor, as far as answering the question for this case, is the fact that this court is already in the process of changing the law. I submit that Smith versus Southwest Feed Yards, Miller, and other cases move in a more positive direction, the direction which we believe this case is squarely in the middle of. You don't have to change the law to reverse this case, because we fit both the no trial by ambush concepts and the difficult or impossible circumstances. Now, I've already mentioned the fact that there was prior deposition. The fourth factor is that there was the testimony that was actually admitted was itself deposition testimony. So there's no question that every party knew what the substance of these witnesses' testimony was going to be. And the fifth and final factor demonstrating no trial by ambush is the fact that there was a six-day delay between the time the trial court made its ruling of good cause until the time the evidence was actually introduced to the jury. Now, I understand that Alvarado and Transamerican, as this court is using Transamerican and Alvarado, is not suggesting that a mere delay or postponement should be available for curing a 215.5 violation. On the other hand, it does go to cure trial by ambush.
These were videotaped depositions, or was there any other use made other than there was no live testimony, as I recall?
Well, Your Honor, from these witnesses, it was just videotaped deposition testimony. But the crucial point is deposition testimony was also used and introduced through a backdoor mechanism by the live testifying expert, Dr. Lapps, who said, I've summarized all the depositions, I've relied on that depositions, I'm interpreting for the jury, and I'm here to tell you that on the basis of all that, Alcoa is grossly negligent, that it was unreasonable in its actions with regard to the mail-out program, unreasonable with regard to its actions on seat belts, and unreasonable with regard to its actions on the training program. That is the use of the testimony that is a difficult and impossible circumstance, and it constitutes gamesmanship, the kind of gamesmanship that the court said was not doable in the Exxon versus West Texas case, precisely because 215.5 was used to shield or preclude the revelation of what that deposition testimony was, and instead, arguably, was an attempt to conceal what the testimony really was so that the jury would only hear what the live testifying witness said the testimony constituted, abusing what that testimony was and requiring for the jury to hear what the facts reveal instead of what the facts conceal. They needed to hear that testimony.
Any questions?
Yes, I'd like to hear his remaining 5 points.
Your Honor, the 5 points on difficult or impossible circumstances are these. The first, that the testimony was used by the Bullocks. That is, they sponsored the testimony to their live testifying expert. That memorandum demonstrated that...
Can you state them without argument?
Yes, Your Honor. The second factor is that the testifying expert used the depositions. The third factor is that there was unanticipated... The third factor is that there was an abuse of that deposition testimony. She mischaracterized it. The fourth is that there was unanticipated need for the testimony because she changed her testimony from the time of deposition until the time of trial. And the fifth is that that scenario constitutes trial by ambush of Alcoa because of concealment and gamesmanship to give the testimony to the witness and ask the witness to use it and then use 215 to try to keep that evidence from being heard by the jury.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Rob Ramsey and Mr. Reggie Beasley will present argument for the respondents. Mr. Ramsey will open with the first 15 minutes.
May it please the court, we recognize that this court has allowed the testimony of non-designated witnesses in certain limited circumstances, such as in Smith versus Southwest Feed Yards and Miller versus Bynum, where you had the situation of an individual party fact witness. Alcoa tries to fit this case into that exception or urge you to create another exception that they say is not nearly so narrow as that, but we submit that this court took into consideration the fact that it's important for an individual party to have his day in court to testify, and that to allow the testimony of a non-designated party fact witness is much different than allowing the testimony of a non-designated non-party expert witness, which is what we have in this case, or two of them. They also suggest, Alcoa does, that we should reasonably anticipate with the same degree of certainty that the non-designated expert will testify, just as we should anticipate that an individual party fact witness may testify in certain circumstances. But that's not realistic, because I can sit here and really, or stand here and not think of any case probably where there's an individual party who will not likely testify, particularly when in answers to other discovery requests they've given that knowledge. But when you're trying to find out people with knowledge of relevant facts, that's not the same as finding out experts and what their area will be, what opinions they may offer, and whose experts they're going to be, particularly in a multi-party case. So the exception that they're asking to create in this case is a lot different than the one that we had in Smith and Miller.
Counsel, are you going to articulate a response in regard to his argument about cumulative evidence and harmless error?
Yes, Your Honor. Although some of the witnesses testified in the same area, the basic difference between the witnesses' testimony was that their witnesses had backgrounds, came from different backgrounds. One had worked for a large forklift manufacturer. And the basic difference was that their witnesses testified that Alcoa was not grossly negligent, was not consciously indifferent, whereas our witnesses testified that Alcoa was. And yes, they covered some of the same territory, but this was a case where there were a lot of differences of opinion. And in a close case, or close issues at least like this, I think it would be difficult to say that any testimony was cumulative, particularly when they had disinterested third-party witnesses, experts, backing up their case in addition to the people that worked for them. So for no other reason, even though they may have touched on some of these areas, for example, if our witnesses say, well, yes, we recognize maybe there was some disagreement in the area of whether they should have fitted the seat belts among the manufacturers, yet our witness would also say there was no disagreement among engineers, and they should have known about it anyway, and even if there was a disagreement, they still should have been doing it. Whereas their witnesses come in and say, well, no, they were reasonable in not doing it. They were very conscious of their employee safety, on and on about what a good employer Alcoa was and how conscious they were of the safety of their employer. So we perceive that to be the difference, where it's not cumulative in that situation, even though, yes, they testified in some of the same areas. And maybe they did make some points and they had to give some concessions in certain areas, yet it was not the ringing endorsement that their witnesses gave to the way that Alcoa handled things, not just with the seatbelts, but their failure to train, to stay inside if the forklift turned over. So this would be what we would say would be the difference.
How about harmless error?
Well, our harm was, as the trial counsel for Alcoa pointed out, when it got time to call these depositions into evidence, that the harm was we were left in a situation where we had deposed, and the trial counsel for the Bullocks had deposed these witnesses at a time thinking that they were Eaton's witnesses, which they were. Eaton later settled. It was not in the case. And really didn't go into the detail or develop certain theories that trial counsel told the trial court at this hearing that he would have developed had he known Alcoa would call.
And nonetheless, you designated these witnesses as your expert witnesses.
We did, Your Honor. And we did that in response to Eaton's having designated them, trying to follow the rule and be very cautious and anticipating that possibly we might get in a trial situation where we might want to develop theories other than the theories that they would give, maybe in response or in support of Eaton. We might want to develop something against Alcoa, and yet if we hadn't designated them as our witnesses, Alcoa could object and say, you didn't designate them, you're going outside the scope of their testimony. So we were trying to be safe and follow the rule of doing that.
Opposing counsel has suggested that you really got all of this in through your own expert, I guess. You had another witness that referred to this?
That referred to the depositions?
Right.
I think she referred that she had relied on depositions and information they had furnished her, and among the depositions were these depositions, yes. But I don't think it's unreasonable for them to anticipate that our expert is going to rely on any depositions that may have been given in the case to give her opinion. And we will disagree with them when they say that Dr. Lau, which I think is the expert you're talking about, changed her opinion somehow at the trial. That's just not accurate. She gave the same basic opinion at trial as she did at her deposition. That came out on the cross-examination. And she says, my basic opinion has not changed. Their trial counsel tries to lead her into saying somehow that she's changing her opinion. He says, well, didn't you say this? Didn't you say they weren't consciously indifferent back then? And she says something like, well, I don't know who you're referring to by they, but I'll tell you what I think. I think they should have known this. They should have done something about it. And that's my opinion now, and it was then, and it really hasn't changed. And really, they had no basis to say that she changed her testimony. Yes, maybe she looked at some more documents between the time that that happened, but she also told them in the deposition that she would, or I think at least she said she should have reviewed other documents, and whether she did or not, or would or not, we don't know, but she certainly let them know that she intended to look at other documents. I don't think it's ever unreasonable to think that...
Did she refer to or rely upon at any point in her testimony the deposition testimony given to these designated experts?
I think she probably did in connection with other depositions. Yes, Your Honor.
Did she testify in her deposition that alcohol was grossly negligent?
Yes, well, she said it was consciously different. Yes, that they were grossly negligent.
So you disagree with Alcoa's contention that that was a change from her deposition to her trial testimony?
Yes, Your Honor, I disagree because although she may not have said it in the exact words that you just phrased, it, were they grossly negligent, the basis of her saying that they were consciously indifferent to the safety of their employees, is the same thing she said at her deposition.
Well, I understand that the factual or technical basis that might underlie that opinion could be the same, but did she use the words consciously indifferent or gross negligence in her deposition?
I don't know that she used the words gross negligence. I think she said they were indifferent, or she might not have even said consciously indifferent. I couldn't say that for certain, but I think the essence of what she was saying was the same.
If she referred to or relied upon this deposition testimony of these expert witnesses at any point in her testimony, what is the harm in allowing that deposition testimony to be directly introduced in its own right, without interpretation, without third-party reliance?
Well, the harm, Your Honor, is had we realized that they may use these witnesses, the trial counsel, as he explained to the trial court, would have had more in that deposition, would have developed things further and further support against the case against Alcoa. And if they thought that they wanted to impeach her or use that in cross-examining her, they had the opportunity to do that, and they didn't do it. Nor did they object that she was somehow outside the scope of her designated testimony and somehow saying something that she hadn't said before. They didn't object to that. Because really, she wasn't saying anything any different. But the harm would be that the deposition they introduced was not fully developed from the Bullock's point of view.
Are they bound to use it as a tool of cross-examination rather than as rebuttal?
I would say if they have not designated the witnesses, they should be limited to the cross-examination.
You agree that they could use it for cross-examination or impeachment?
I think that's probably the harder question, Your Honor. If they had done it as cross-examination and brought in excerpts from it, possibly so.
The problem is, I see is once you've opened the gate, you know, how do you limit which horses come through it?
Well, I don't think we opened the gate by directly referring to anything. She relied on lots of other things besides those depositions, but I think
was there some reference to those particular depositions, or was there simply a...
Not by name. We didn't introduce it in the sense of opening the gate that, what about these particular people? There were references to other specific depositions, but not those. I think where we open the gate is if we open it any further than the limited exceptions that are in Smith and Miller and get into saying, well, if just because a plaintiff or remaining non-selling defendant is going to come up and rely on a plaintiff's answer to the settling defendant's question, that's one thing, like in the Thai court case, that's defensive use of what I've come to call the multi-party interrogatory reliance doctrine, which says defensively, yes, you can keep us from calling witnesses we haven't designated. But I don't think that opens the gate to letting them say, even if there was deposition testimony, well, we can come in and use these witnesses basically because you used them. And that is one of the arguments they were advancing to the trial court. Although they said they're not relying on inadvertence, the essence of this case is it was their inadvertence that brought this about, because their trial counsel admitted to the trial court that he was quite surprised that they had not designated these witnesses. So whether they were entitled to rely on our designation or not, they really didn't do it in this case.
So your position is if one party designates a principal expert and the other party does not list that person in their own designation, that the party who does not list it cannot call that witness in his own case?
Yes, sir.
He could cross-examine him, I take it, but could not call him on his own.
Well, I suppose I'll have to concede you can always cross-examine an expert witness on anything that they rely on.
It's typical tactics at trial, is it not, to use the other side's expert as much as you can?
If you can make good use of it, sure is, sir.
They did.
Yes, and they did in this case.
You were referencing the Piper title against Lacey case. Explain again how that case is the converse of the situation we have here.
Well, I believe in that case where you have, if I may use as an example in our case, a non-settling defendant, in this case Alcoa Remains, and the settling defendant in our case, for example, Eaton, had sent questions to the Bullocks' plaintiff, interrogatory, saying, tell us who your witnesses are. We answer and tell you who our witnesses are going to be. Alcoa does not send us any interrogatories, and yet Eaton is no longer in the case. We can't then come to trial and say, well, we can call anybody we want to. We're not bound by those answers that the non-settling defendant, in response to the non-settling defendant's questions, because, yes, our answer should necessarily be identical. If no matter who asked us the question, we're going to answer the same who our witnesses are going to be. And in the Thai court case, you're in a situation where you are trying to prevent someone from calling a witness whom they have not designated. Whereas in our case, they're not that we were trying to do it. They're trying to make an offensive use of that doctrine and bring in a witness just because, or among the reasons at least, because we had designated the witness. And I will also note that the trial court was very specific in finding in our case that that was the only good cause the trial court found in this case. The trial court did not find they couldn't reasonably anticipate this other testimony. He didn't find that because we took the depositions or we may or may not have been surprised that was good cause or any combination of those factors. He was very careful to limit it and said it more than once. He says, my decision stands or falls on the good cause or the designation by the plaintiffs. And we would say that before he can exercise his discretion to allow the testimony, he must find good cause. On the other hand, if the only good cause he found was not good cause, he's abused his discretion. No one has really challenged his use of his discretion in saying, well, I don't think that you're right that you couldn't have anticipated this testimony. I think maybe it was about the same. Or I'm not going to be persuaded just because they took depositions. Certainly there was an element of surprise here, although that's not the test. But as the Court of Appeals and Corpus said, it's a tactical surprise. It's potentially destructive, and this case was actually destructive to trial strategy, because just the way you approach a case, either knowing or not knowing who your witnesses are going to be, affects your strategy at trial.
I'm having some difficulty wrestling with this concept that you can designate an expert, you can depose that expert, while you don't introduce that deposition testimony directly at trial, you can have another expert rely upon that testimony for limited purposes. And then the other side doesn't have the authority or the wherewithal, the right to go to your source and examine that to the extent that it's been developed. And you're the one that deposes, you're the one that largely determines the extent to which that is developed.
Yes, Your Honor, I understand what you're saying.
I have difficulty with that concept when we're talking in terms of full disclosure.
Yes, Your Honor, and I suppose I must be having difficulty explaining my position on that.
Why you should be able to use it limited to your purposes, the other side should not be able to go back and examine it. It's somewhat like citing authorities in a brief of this court and then saying we can't examine those authorities.
I understand, Your Honor, but as we went to this trial, we were not expecting that they were going to do that. Perhaps, as part of a trial strategy, they wouldn't have asked her to rely on this if that was the case. That might be something potentially destructive to trial strategy just in that, from the trial counsel's point of view. But I think mainly the fact that they didn't designate, we didn't fully develop because they weren't designated as their witnesses, even though they may have the right to come in and cross-examine and do all those things, yet so should we have had the right to have a full record there for them to look at if they were going to do that. And that's about the best I can say on that.
This problem could be solved by one party simply designating all of the other persons designated by all of the other parties. Could it not?
I think it could, and I think that's...
How is trial by ambush reduced, the possibility of trial by ambush reduced by that?
I think it would be reduced if, because at least in this case, if we had the warning that they intended to use anyone we designated, at least that would have told us something, and we would have known that ahead of time. We could have either objected to the form of their answer or just lived with it and said, yes, okay, we're on notice they may use these witnesses. But we didn't have that opportunity in this case.
You're just asking that they do the same thing that you did with regard to designating these experts that had originally designated by the settling party.
Yes, Your Honor. I feel we're being penalized, or they're attempting to penalize us for obeying the rules and being diligent and trying to use that. When they didn't obey the rules and inadvertently didn't designate the witnesses, we shouldn't have to suffer the consequences for their lack of designation.
The Court of Appeals said that it applied an abuse of discretion standard to the trial court's finding of good cause. Can you explain your view of what the range of that discretion is?
Well, I don't think, as the trial court limited itself, that if his only finding of good cause, as he stated in the record, was we designate the witness, I don't think that's within his discretion, because I think that's not what these other cases are saying. I think the rule says you must designate your own witnesses, and he's beyond his discretion in letting them do that when the rule doesn't authorize that, and the cases don't authorize that either.
So whatever his discretion may be, if he states a wrong reason, then it's a reversal?
I view this as different than his just stating a wrong reason. I think this goes beyond that when he, in his discretion, rejects the other reason. Because he did, as Mr. Rowe said, it was up to the trial court to make that decision, exercise his discretion, even when they bring him these reasons that they want to advance. If he, in his discretion, rejects them, that's not the same as deciding the right thing for the wrong reason. He has considered what they presented to him and said, I reject all of your other theories. The only one I can see that works is this one right here. As it turns out, that one doesn't work. So he has abused his discretion.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We're still another respondent to argue.
Rex Easy, Victoria. My firm tried this lawsuit in Edna. And some of the things that are important to us have not, I need to respond to. I don't think that backdoor use is a fair term. I think that implies something insidious. What we did was to prevent what happened to them, we designated all of the other parties' witnesses, because during a multi-party product liability, mixed product liability, and gross negligence case such as we had here, You cannot be sure of what the experts are going to say throughout the development of discovery. And so we cross-designate all the other parties' witnesses so that what happened to them wouldn't happen to us. They were not our witnesses. That's not a fair statement to say that because we cross-designated them to be fully prepared that they somehow became our witnesses. What we did was put Dr. Lila Locks on the stand from Rice to talk about warnings and decals on forklifts and what warnings that the forklift industry gave to Alcoa. And the The point is that we asked her questions based on what Eaton, the settling defendant, had, what their experts had said with regard to the decals that flowed to Alcoa. And we were just using deposition testimony from witnesses that we had designated.
What's the difference? If you rely upon them, you've designated them, even if you designated them because they were another party's witnesses. You deposed them, you designated them. Your testifying expert relied upon their deposition testimony. Why should not other parties in the trial equally be able to rely upon that in the interest of full disclosure?
Because we didn't fully prepare those, we didn't fully prepare our case with those experts against Alcoa. There was areas we should have gone into, that we could have gone into. There may have been other things we needed to explore that would have taken a lot longer in the depositions. We were expecting Eaton to bring them to trial. And at that point, we could have gone into the things that they said that may have helped Alcoa. But we were scared to go into them in the deposition because Eaton had designated them and not Alcoa. And Alcoa never designated, and I'd be less than frank if I represented to this court we weren't pretty pleased when that trial started and they weren't designated.
So why didn't you just not show them to your expert?
Well, the expert had seen those depositions from way before.
Why not just not show them to them?
You mean
no,
ask?
We have not relied on those. I have not relied on those depositions.
Well, Your Honor, what I'm trying to say is Dr. Louse formed her opinions in the case throughout the case. And before Eaton settled, we deposed those people. And Dr. Louse looked at those depositions way back then, so her opinions were already formed. I mean, she can't just because something artificial happens in the trial of the lawsuit where one of the co-defendants settles, I mean, she can't intellectually be honest. I mean, she can't just change her opinions over that. I think that'd be intellectual dishonesty for Dr. Louse.
Were these experts local, or were they could you have redeposed them during that six-day delay?
They were from out of state.
Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel.
Yes, I have one other question.
I'm sorry. Mr. Eaton?
You said you would have asked more questions at the deposition if you'd known that this was going to happen, or that if Eaton had called them at trial, you could have examined the experts then, the witnesses.
Yes, that was my point.
Why couldn't you? But you couldn't examine them when they called them 6 days later because they were unavailable, or what was the reason that you couldn't do that then at trial?
They did not come to trial.
But if Eaton had come and had offered those depositions, you would be in the same position, and what were you going to do about that?
Well, then we would have developed them on cross-examination at that time.
But you couldn't if all they used were the depositions.
But those witnesses, well, that's true. If Eaton would have stayed in the case
and used the depositions, you would have been in the same position.
Yes, except that those depositions would have been sponsored and offered by Eaton. And you see, the problem with this deal is those witnesses were Eaton's witnesses, and the whole flavor of their testimony was directed in the contest between Bullock and Eaton. So when they were independent witnesses. They were the only non-Alcoa experts. And that was the problem.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I think a lot of this confusion about whose witnesses they were and how the depositions were used are answered by this deposition. This is exhibit number 9 you have in front of you. I would ask that you take a look at the third page, point number 7. The instruction, and keep in mind, please, this is dated November 28, 1990. The assertion that her views were already set in concrete before she saw these depositions is simply not true. The testimony at trial will reflect that this date, the date of this memo, is the date that she went to Bullock's attorney's office to go and take a look, to go and prepare her report. This says, read these depositions. These depositions had not been read before. Number 7 says, review Entwistle's deposition. He's the guy. And his testimony with regard to the Clark mail-out and free retrofit with seatbelts. With this information, Alcoa was guilty of gross negligence in failing to equip their forklifts with seatbelts and train their employees in the proper use of seatbelts in the particular environment that they would be using them in. They this testimony to the witness, who had never before seen it, tells her what she can testify to, that now her opinion can be gross negligence, and the suggestion that this was that makes this testimony Eaton's testimony or Alcoa's testimony and not the Bullock's testimony is simply not reality. When they tell somebody that you can review this testimony and then conclude that Alcoa was guilty of gross negligence and then does, at page 916 of the Statement of Facts, testifies to precisely this concept, based on that review, they are the Bullock's witnesses. And the suggestion contrary simply cannot be taken seriously.
Could you respond to the argument that the trial court's basis for finding good cause is different than the good cause that you're arguing today?
Your Honor, this court has never before, in any case I'm familiar with, limited the analysis of good cause to what the trial court found. In Clark v. Trailways, this court found that there was implicit good cause. In Galvin v. Gulf Oil, the Houston Court of Appeals did the same thing. This court has never limited that. Second, probably more importantly, this is an abuse of discretion issue, and that requires a review of the entire record. And a review of the entire record reveals the factors that I've brought to you today, these 10 different factors. Now, and thirdly, the trial court did not reject the other factors. It simply says the one factor that I'm going to base my decision on is prior designation. But the other arguments were made, but the trial court does not say, with one exception, does not reject it. The only argument that the trial court rejects in the statement of facts is surprise or ambush or harm. That can't be a factor under G. So there's no question that the trial court knew what the correct standard was, attempted to use it. But the factors we are bringing before you today are properly considered by this court, and the suggestion that it should be limited is not consistent with the standard of review for abuse of discretion or any other decision of this court or any other court of appeals decision of which I'm aware. Second, Your Honors, there should be no question but that Entwistle and Kirby were both the Bullock's witnesses. The key issue was Alcoa saying we didn't receive the mail out, saying we should be putting seatbelts on our forklifts. And Entwistle testified at 2144 in the Statement of Facts that I believe Alcoa got the retrofit from Clark and Eaton and expected Alcoa to see the ads and the other information. Also, Kirby testified that this information may have saved Bullock's life, the information said to disseminate it to the operators. There are a host of other examples where both Kirby and Entwistle gave testimony that was fundamentally in support of the positions advanced by Bullock. And thirdly, Louts clearly used that deposition testimony. I think that's been admitted, but at 924 in the statement, she says she's summarizing the deposition testimony and giving the jury her interpretation of it. And at 959 says she's analyzing the depositions and the evidence.
You began your argument today by telling us this case was important for us to write on because of the bad health, bad state of the health of 215. Could you summarize in short what it is that we should do in order to get it well?
What this court should say is that there are factors that can demonstrate reasonably conclusively to a trial court that there was no trial by ambush, and that those factors are sufficient, as we have found in Smith, Miller, Remington, and Exxon. What would be even more helpful, what would be even more dispositive as additional factors would be difficult or impossible circumstances, such as we required in Clark, or we said we wanted in Clark, in Alvarado, and as one of the concurrences said in Smith. This case presents both. It gives
trial courts and counsel some guidance as to what factors will permit a good cause finding. Identification of the witness through designation by the complaining party is one of those factors. Depositions and use, sponsorship of the testimony is the icing on the cake. And the gamesmanship in trying to stop a party from using on cross-examination, on direct, what apparently is conceded it can do on cross-examination, is gamesmanship of the highest order, and that constitutes trial by ambush, which this court will not permit and has rejected.
Any other questions? Mr. Roach, in the, was there any tender of this deposition testimony based on Rule 106, the rule of optional completeness?
There was no statement in the statement of facts to that effect.
Anything else? Thank you, counsel. The court will now take a brief recess.
Yeah,